Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we're going to be talking with documentary filmmaker Michael Kleiman about his film, The Last Survivor. This is a documentary that follows stories of survivors from genocides and mass atrocities of the Holocaust, Rwanda, Darfur, and Congo.
Yeah, you know, I just saw this documentary, Christy, the other day. It's powerful. We're really fortunate to have Michael on our show today. I think our listeners will really appreciate hearing these stories and ultimately seeing the film. But we also have some incredibly interesting research that matters today, Christy. What are we going to be talking about?
Well, the first one is about multiple sclerosis. We're also going to talk about diet drinks and diabetes, as well as
colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. And does it matter whether or not your doctor's doing it on the first case of the day or the last?
And about do not resuscitate orders. So first, we'll jump right in on the first study, which is about sun exposure and mono being linked loosely to multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, this was a piece of research that was looking at, you know, we don't know exactly what causes multiple sclerosis, where the immune system kind of attacks its own nerves, and everyone probably knows someone with multiple sclerosis. But in this journal, Neurology, they try to look at what factors might be linked to that outcome.
They looked at 7 years' worth of data, and they tried to link certain geographic areas and factors about those areas with rates of multiple sclerosis. And they found that areas that have a relatively lower amount of sunlight, which is linked with vitamin D, and higher rates of getting the infection mononucleosis also had higher rates of MS. What'd you think, Adam?
Yeah, so this MS is multiple sclerosis, which is incredibly frightening because, you know, so it's debilitating. I've got family members, we have patients, have friends.
It's awful. You know,
it is, and so we all know that. And we want to, like, jump on, I think, a piece of research that says, oh, maybe we should immediately get more sun exposure and we should avoid that monovirus, which, unfortunately, 95% of Americans are exposed to at some point in time. So the EBV, I don't know. This research doesn't shake my socks, Christy.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think it is exciting to think that we might have some links to have some possible developing explanation, but we really don't have, I mean, this doesn't tell us a whole lot, except that maybe vitamin D and maybe mono have a role somehow with multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, so stay tuned, but we wouldn't recommend you make any changes in how you right now see this issue. Just interesting and file it away. But our next research is something that we think you can do something with.
So this is about diet sodas and whether or not that raises your risk of having diabetes. So
do you drink diet soda, Christy?
I drink diet sodas, Coke Zero.
I don't drink Coke Zero, but I drink Diet Coke. And sometimes I've felt a little guilty, not that I get diabetes, but that it may be bad for me. And this research doesn't say whether it's bad for me, but it does say whether or not drinking diet sodas would increase my risk or your risk of diabetes.
It does. A study done out of Harvard University, it was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, looking at 40,000 men who were followed for 20 years about their dietary habits and what sort of medical conditions they developed.
Right. And as expected, if you drink sugar-sweetened beverages, you drink that Coke, regular Coke, or the regular Pepsi, or whatever, you are more likely to get diabetes. But just drinking the diet-sweetened sodas, when you control for obesity, so in other words, a lot of the people who were obese were drinking diet sodas, but once you control for that, there's no increased rate of diabetes. So it appears that it's okay.
It does. It appears that it's okay. And, you know, these are difficult things to tease out because maybe people are drinking more diet sodas if they're at risk for diabetes and that sort of thing. But this shows that really drinking that diet soda does not raise your diabetes risk. And that sort of makes sense to me, Adam, don't you think?
It does. And it's reassuring. I think, you know, we oftentimes, Christy, you and I think more like about, you know, moderation. And mm-hmm. certainly if you're drinking one or two diet sodas a day, there's nothing right now that indicates that that's really harmful.
It's probably okay.
Yeah, and one little parenthetic thing about this research, Christy, is they found that drinking regular coffee, and we've covered this on the show before, on a regular basis was linked to a lower risk of diabetes, confirming some
another,
other research.
Yeah, another
and then
study.
You're happy about that.
I am. Okay.
Well, let's our next research that matters, because again, something that I think does matter, and it's going to affect, I'm going to have to get a colonoscopy sometime soon. I'm 50, so I've got to do it, and it'll affect maybe how I do it.
So the idea is if you're doing, as a physician is doing multiple procedures throughout the day, does his or her performance change throughout the day? And of course, we're involved with work hours for physicians, for resident physicians, you know, really latching on to the idea in America that doctors shouldn't work quite so many hours in a row because it could lead to damage in patient care.
And in this particular study, which was in the American Journal of Gastroenterology, they looked at if when a physician or could be a trained nurse, but does a procedure like a colonoscopy, some procedure over and over again, later in the day, do they start perhaps not making the same sort of diligence? Do they maybe miss some, in this case, polyps that they would pick up if they were doing it earlier in the day when maybe they weren't so tired or just used to seeing the same thing over and over?
So these doctors doing colonoscopies are looking for the polyps to remove them before they become cancer. And in this study, as they tracked them over 4 months among 28 different colonoscopy doctors, they found that at the beginning of the day, the doctors found a lot more polyps than they did in the 12th procedure of the day. In the 12th procedure, they would spot just more than half of the polyps compared to the ones detected during the first procedure.
Right, and I don't think this is just because all those people with lots of polyps are coming in earlier in the day. They're self-selecting here. I think what this means is that, and the authors have some good ideas possibly why, that as the day goes on, maybe you're running late, maybe you have to the procedure a little bit faster, maybe you say, oh, that's a smaller one, I'm not going to worry about it. There could be lots
maybe
of reasons
tired.
Why. Tired. But the simple fact is, if you're picking up less polyps and it's everything else being equal, you might be missing some earlier signs of precancers.
It's true. I mean, it's more important that you get a really good prep, that you drink all the stuff to kind of clean out
your
bowels.
Prep, meaning that stuff they call go lightly that is not
that
light at all.
That makes you have diarrhea. it's not pleasant.
I'm not looking forward to that.
Yeah, you'll have to tell us about
but
that.
But what I tell you, what I am going to do differently is I am going to schedule my colonoscopy earlier in the morning. And one of the other ideas they have here, which I thought was a good idea, is to say, ask your doctor, what are they doing to compensate for this? How are they taking this into account, this research? Because it doesn't mean you can't have a colonoscopy later in the day, but it means perhaps that there should be some procedures in place, like maybe having two different people, one person starting at a different time. Just some different ideas, and I'm sure there are more.
I would agree with that. The last one is about do not resuscitate orders.
Yep, and this is a huge issue because when people come into the hospital, frequently they have DNR orders. Sometimes these people are healthy, but they've had DNR orders in case they were in an irreversible coma. And so they come into the hospital and they say, yes, I have a DNR order. And the question is, does that really matter if you're going in for surgery?
And this study looks at people who have DNR orders compared with matched other people who are supposed to be very similar in their health status to see what happened within 30 days after surgery compared with the group who did not have the DNR orders.
Yes, and published in the journal, the American Medical Association, they found that almost three times as many people, 23% of the people with these DNR orders, do not resuscitate orders, died within a month after surgery compared to 8% of those who didn't have these orders. This is a huge issue, Christy, and it's certainly these patients may be sicker on average, but it wasn't just that.
Well, it wasn't just that. And that, I mean, of course, I've read this and have thought, okay, well, folks who have a DNR order are probably more sicker. They're probably thinking about their comfort with dying if that is, you know, in the cards for them in the near future, and thinking about how that plays a role in their healing after surgery.
Yeah, I think a take-home point for me and maybe for you, Christy, is that we need to revisit this DNR orders. When you come into the hospital and say, is this really what you wanted? If something happened to you in the next 30 days here, something that maybe isn't an end-of-life issue, because there may be the way doctors view these patients differently. If you have a DNR order, you may not get the exact same care. We don't know, but I worry about it.
It doesn't mean do not treat.
Absolutely.
But it's a complicated conversation to have with patients, Adam. And yeah, I really think we should do a whole show about this because
absolutely,
it's hard to communicate and really help
particularly
patients
when
understand
you're really sick late at night.
About.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Christy, we've had a chance to talk about that you should think about these DNR orders, that you maybe should think about when in the day if you're going to have your colonoscopy.
Some good news that diet soda does not raise your risk of diabetes, and some possible links between sun exposure and mononucleosis to getting MS or multiple sclerosis.
Well, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with documentary filmmaker Michael Kleiman about his film, The Last Survivor. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with documentary filmmaker Michael Kleiman about his film, The Last Survivor, which follows stories of survivors from genocides and mass atrocities, the Holocaust, Rwanda, Darfur, and Congo. And this is going to be a difficult but a very interesting and enlightening conversation, Adam.
Yes, Christy. You know, I was fortunate to see this documentary recently and so happy that Michael can join us today as a co-founder and creative director of Righteous Pictures and director of this film. Welcome to our show, Michael.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, this documentary, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, it. I know The Last Survivor, having seen it, shot on four different continents and in five different countries and is now being screened and winning film awards across the country. It's an incredibly personal story. Tell us a little bit about how you even came to be involved in coming up with this idea and moving forward to really tackling not just genocide like the Holocaust, but looking at genocide and mass atrocities at four times.
Sure. Well, it's, you know, I made the film with my co-director, Michael Pertnoy, so I can tell you my story, and he has his own. But, you know, for me, I grew up in my house and my family. On my father's side, my grandmother and her three sisters were all fled from Belgium during the Nazi invasion, and they were hidden in a barn in the south of France for 6 months before they were finally able to escape into Portugal and then finally come over to the U.S. So I had kind of grown up a little bit with hearing some of these stories. And then when I was in college, a junior in college in 2005, I had heard very much just kind of in passing about this genocide that had been going on in Darfur for 2 years at that point. And, you know, I was a very politically aware student, at least considered myself to be, tried to keep current, you know, keep up on current events and all that. And I was just really shocked and just disappointed that here there's this genocide that was going on for 2 years, and I had never even heard about it.
And so what, decided to tackle it as your main area of focus?
I'm sorry?
I was just thinking about you as a filmmaker and all the different mm-hmm. experiences you must have had in college mm-hmm. and in your training to mm-hmm. take on something so important and so dark.
Right.
It must have been a big leap.
Yes. Well, I mean, at the time, you know, when it started in 2005 when I was in college, I decided to do this very small sliver of the story, and I started making a short documentary with just media professors, communications professors, talking about why, you know, it was absent from the news and why we weren't hearing about it. And, you know, it was a very student film, not anything too grand or great, but I always wanted to do something more. And so then shortly after school, a good friend of mine from college and a fellow filmmaker, Michael Pertnoy, came to me with this idea for a film he had been speaking about with some Holocaust survivors in Miami, where he was from, which was going to be a film that focused on Holocaust survivors and their focus, you know, their lives today, their hopes for the future, their visions for the future. And he talked to me about whether I'd want to make the film with him, and he and I really talked about how we make a film about the Holocaust today and how we speak to our generation about the Holocaust. And we really realized that to do so meant we needed to talk not only about Holocaust survivors, but also, you know, the horrors of Rwanda and Cambodia and Bosnia and Darfur. You know, this vow of never again that came after the Holocaust and has been broken time after time. So well, before, that was the start to it.
Well, and, I know we want to get into the because you really chronicle the lives of four individuals involved in, mm-hmm. in four different genocide mass atrocities. But I wonder if you can just take one step back and help us understand when we talk about a genocide or mass atrocity, what are we really talking about? And I think you mentioned about survivors already as a unique feature of what you're trying to bring out. But there's also this element of that this genocide mass atrocity doesn't have to happen. And so help us understand how you define these so we can understand better what you mean when you say it doesn't have to happen.
Sure. Well, you know, genocide is a legal term. It has this very specific legal definition that has to do with intent. So genocide is defined, you know, not to quote me here, but the law of genocide speaks about the act or attempt of killing part or whole of an entire group. And the intent has to be to pretty much get rid of that group, to destroy it, for that specific reason that it's because of this, you know, you want to get rid of this group, and there's not a political motivation that's the underlying thing. It's not an economic thing. But, you know, just to clarify, there are a lot of conflicts that begin as politically motivated that sort of move into this field of, well, you know, there's some political complications being started by this group here. Wouldn't it be a lot easier if we just got rid of that entire group? And so that is a type of case where it does become genocide.
So in the case of Rwanda,
has a very specific legal definition. Mass atrocity crimes is just a phrase that's used to speak about these horrific acts that, you know, when people are just being killed mindlessly and without much discrimination for who they are. So mass atrocity crimes is a much broader phrase, whereas genocide speaks to a legal phrase.
So in your doctor...
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Well, in terms of how we stop these things, one thing that I truly really learned from the making of The Last Survivor is just how preventable they all are. And Jacqueline, who is this brilliant and very articulate survivor of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, Barry says quite, you know, potently that genocide is not something that happens overnight. You don't just wake up one morning and decide you want to kill your neighbors. So there's this real process that starts with hate and intolerance and discrimination and slowly grows into indiscriminate killing of a certain group. So because of that, you know, we have this opportunity, if we can start to identify the warning signs that are typical of this process, to recognize that these things are happening before it's too late, before we get to the complicated level of something like Darfur that has now been going on for 8 years without any intervention. So that, I think, is the hope in terms of stopping these things, is getting to them before they start.
So in your Rwanda, where in just over 3 months, the Hutus killed, you know, hundreds of thousands of Tutsis, mm-hmm. In the movie, you have some examples of some early warning signs. What were one or two warning signs that went unheeded that we could have perhaps intervened differently?
Sure. Well, I think the clearest warning sign that you see across the board in all of these genocides is a dehumanization campaign. And, you know, that's done very publicly and outwardly. So in the case of Rwanda, for the years leading up to the genocide, the Tutsis, who are the minority group in Rwanda, were referred to on public radio as cockroaches. So this idea that this group of people are less than human. We saw the same thing in the Holocaust when Jews were referred to as rats and made to wear these Jude stars on their shoulders and their arms. So that's a clear warning sign there. There was also, you know, more specific things about weapons and, you know, mass amounts of machetes being imported into Rwanda for, you know, years before the genocide.
So what are your thoughts from hearing these stories about why we continue to do these things? I mean, if we made the declaration never again, And then there are these warning signs, and yet we think of this as something awful that happened a long time ago, and it's happening today.
You know, to the answer of why, I'm not really sure, but I think that was one of our biggest goals with The Last Survivor. Is I think that's the greatest misconception about genocide is, one, that it's happening, something that happened in the past, and two, that it's something that happens very far away. And I think both of those statements are just completely incorrect. Genocide is something that has been with us for as long as we've been human. You know, certainly in recorded history, we have many, many examples, and far too many in modern history. And it's also something that's happened on every single continent in the world. You know, it's happened in Asia. It's happened in Europe. It's happened in the Middle East. It's happened in South America and right here in North America as well. So it is a very misguided perception that people, youth of my generation, tend to have. That this is something that's not part of us anymore, and that it doesn't affect us here.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest Michael Kleiman about his new documentary film, The Last Survivor, and we'll begin to talk about some of the key characters in his film. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with documentary filmmaker Michael Kleiman about his film, The Last Survivor. And we were talking before the break a little bit about just sort of breaking down the misunderstandings that we have in today's society of thinking that genocide and these times of mass atrocities are something that happened either a long time ago or somewhere very far away, and yet they're still very real today. And we wanted a chance to talk a little bit about the four survivors in your documentary, starting a little bit with Hedy.
Yeah. Well, so Hedy Fried is 86 years old. She's a survivor of Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen. And, you know, the way we came to Hedy is, you know, I was speaking earlier about the film sort of started when my co-director, Michael Pertner, was approached by a group of Holocaust survivors in his community in Miami. And they kind of wanted to make a film about survivors and their hopes for the future. And the way they sort of kind of brought this idea to Michael's attention was they invited him to this gathering that they do in Miami, and it turns out all over the world, where Holocaust survivors come together, sometimes once a week, sometimes once a month, sometimes once a year, and they just sort of eat and they dance and they celebrate the lives they still have. And this is called Cafe Europa. And Michael had done a bunch of research about Cafe Europa, and it turned out that the whole thing started in 1984 when a Holocaust survivor in Stockholm named Hedy Fried started a weekly gathering of Holocaust survivors in her community as a sort of social therapy group. And so that's how we came to Hedy Fried. That's really how the film started. She was the first one we met. And we went out to Stockholm to visit her, and she continues doing Cafe 84, as it's called there, once a week. And so we went there, and the plan was to tell a story about Cafe 84. And we went and we filmed there, and we kept speaking with Hedy. And it turned out we learned that Hedy has this incredible story about survivorship from Auschwitz that is, you know, one of the more poignant moments of bravery. You know, one of the things about survivor stories, as horrific as they are, you know, they often pull out these really beautiful things about humans where you see such great moments of bravery and such great moments of caring for other people in the worst of circumstances.
You know,
and
so
we learned that Hedy had such a story involving her and her sister in Auschwitz. And I don't want to get too much into it because I hope, you know, the listeners will want to see the film and see it for themselves. But we ended up hearing that story, and none of Cafe 84 ended up making it into the film. So that's sort of one of those things they tell you as a documentary filmmaker. You start with one story and you ended up telling another. And that was very much the case with Hedy's story in The Last Survivor.
Well, you know, you talk about in one of the trailers for the film and in the film itself that Hedy says that, you know, she heard a negation of the Holocaust and she laughed the first time. The second time she said, you know, I can't laugh. And the third time, she says, I have to speak out about it. And one of your next survivors, Jacqueline, who was part of the Rwanda genocide, really speaks out in the movie. Tell us about her.
Well, Jacqueline is, you know, she's just a remarkable individual. She, you know, she lost pretty much all of her family during the genocide in 1994 when she was just 9 years old. She came to the U.S. To live with a distant uncle here. And she has, I mean, her resilience is just amazing. She's brilliant and ambitious. She's now in her second year of law school at Cardozo Law School in New York City. She's built a she's built a community center for orphans in Rwanda who survived and are still living there.
She's about the same age as you, is she not? Is she about the same age as you? I mean, you guys have got to be close in age to each other.
She's a year younger than me.
And wow.
So that was, you know, to get, I'm 27, I think she's 26. And to get back to your point that we were talking about earlier about this idea that genocide is not a contemporary issue, that it's something that happened back then, I think, you know, Jacqueline happened to be the second of these four survivors who Michael and I met, and we were drawn to her because she really represented a faith and a voice of our generation. You know, here was this young woman who, you know, had the same cultural context as us. She, you know, she sounded like us when she spoke. And it was really, we realized that this was that walking proof that genocide is not just something that happened generations ago. It's unfortunately something that's still very much with us today.
Well, and speaking of faith, Justin's story, you know, from Congo was impressive. That, you know, I think there was a quote that God has always put good people in my path. Everything happens for the purpose. But being able to sort of be grateful after having gone through something so horrific, it's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Justin is, again, 25 years, or he's 26 years old now, I guess, so the same age as me. He has been separated from his family since his village was attacked in the middle of the night in 1996. Doesn't know where his parents are, doesn't know where most of his siblings are. Lived as a refugee on foot for 12 years without anything. And the deep faith, the amazing faith that he has in God and in just believing that these things happen for a reason and able to find the light in such a horrific circumstance is just so inspirational. And it's really been a great privilege of both Michael and I to really get to know Justin and retain him as a great friend, because he's one of those people where you see him and no matter what's bringing you down that day, you see him smile. And you think, if this guy is able to laugh and smile after all he's been through, you know, what I'm dealing with can't be too bad.
Right. And, you know, you're really this survivor advocacy, and it comes through again with your fourth survivor, Adam, who, surviving the Darfur genocide, is found back in Israel, almost like bringing full circle back to your first story with the Holocaust. And yet he's there now organizing demonstrations against the genocide in Darfur. That had to have been special to witness that and film it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think what is so special about Adam is, you know, as you said, his, not only his own brilliance and his own passion, but his ability to kind of bring others together. So he, you know, has been able to organize a whole community of Darfuris in Israel. And Adam really recognized from very early on the importance of education. And when he arrived in Israel, he was not allowed to go to school. And he tried to go to school so he could continue his schooling. You know, he talks about when he was a little kid, education was something that was very important to him. And actually, the first warning sign, to get back into that, that he saw before the genocide in Darfur was that Darfuris were no longer allowed to go to school. So Adam in Israel decided he wanted to get back into school. And he became, you know, he fought the Israeli government and the UN and became the first Darfuri minor that was allowed to go to school. He graduated from Yamin Ord, which is a boarding school in the north that started for orphans that were orphaned by the Holocaust in the 50s. So that's really kind of spanned the generations. And now he's studying at university. But what's great about Adam is not only does he get his education, but now he's working with other Darfuri children, making sure that they get their education and that they're assimilating well in Israeli schools, because he really believes that in order to end this cycle of genocide, to create a peaceful and strong country, it's going to require educated individuals. So that remains his goal, is to help the people in Israel remain strong, to take this time as a time to rebuild and to improve themselves so that they can one day go home and rebuild and improve their country.
Well, it's remarkable that each of these survivors have not only, you know, made it through such horrific experiences in their life, but have really become powerful agents of change. And you're certainly, with your film, using it as an agent of change. We want to be sure our listeners have an opportunity to see your film and to find out how they can make a difference. Give us your website information.
Sure. Well, first of all, you can visit thelastsurvivor.com, and there's more information about the film. There's a few short videos about the film, and then there are links that you can find screenings near you. You know, April is Genocide Prevention Month, so starting April 1st through June 20th, which is World Refugee Day, we're running a community screenings campaign around the country, and I think we have about 60 screenings nationwide, so you can look to see if there's any screenings near you. You can also host a screening, so you can bring the film to your community if it's not already there. And then the other option, which will be available in the coming weeks, will be live streaming on Snag Films, snagfilms.com.
And there'll be S-N-A-G, about that on the S-N-A- website. S-N-A-G-F-I-L-M-S?
You got it.
Wow, that's really good. And I know that people will want to see the film. And I must also say, which I didn't hear discussed, but the soundtrack is haunting and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I know that's also available for purchase. So I hope that people will take advantage of that as well.
Absolutely. The music really, we found a great composer in Keith Kenneth, who did a great job with the score, and it just pulls out all those themes of darkness and resilience that we hope the film would get across. And like you said, that's available for purchase on thelastsurvivor.com.
Well, thank you, Michael, for your work and for taking time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with the documentary filmmaker Michael Kleiman about his film, The Last Survivor.
And if you want to hear a little bit more, you can visit Behind the Scenes, and you can hear just a little more discussion that Christy and I have had with Mr. Kleiman.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions, your concerns.
Yeah, you know, Christy, we continue to get a variety of really good questions and comments from listeners, and we can put them on an upcoming show. They can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And let's listen to our very first question from a listener today about lactose intolerance.
I'd like to know more information about lactose intolerance in adults and how it occurs, some of the best ways to get tested for it or not tested for it, and some of the best products to help with lactose intolerance and problems related to that.
So that's a really good question and a tricky one to answer. I mean, for those of you who may not be aware of lactose intolerance, this is where people get belly pain, bloating, sometimes more gas and diarrhea that's related to dairy products or to lactose-containing foods.
Yeah, they're missing an enzyme necessary to digest this lactose. And while it is something that is common relatively in our society, particularly among more darkly pigmented individuals, African Americans, it is not something that actually, we did some research that says more people think they have it than they actually do have it.
Right.
So it's one of those things where it's overdiagnosed rather than the reality. So it's common among certain groups, but maybe overdiagnosed too.
And it's a tricky thing to do because if to really help yourself, if you are having these symptoms and this intolerance, is that you really have to be very careful about your diet intake to reduce the amount of lactose that you take in your diet. And that's hard to do.
It is. And a lot of people will go to, they'll go to soy-based products, mm-hmm, instead of milk-based products, and certainly avoiding the foods that are offending agents. But again, a lot of people go to these products without really ever having a formal test. And the formal test could be expensive and invasive, but it, you know, an easy test would be, does every time that you have a lactose product, do you get bloating and diarrhea versus not? And a lot of times people can find that maybe they got bloated and diarrhea sometimes, but not most of the time. And then those people probably don't truly have a lactose deficiency. What about this probiotic question?
Well, the probiotics, it makes sense that it could have a benefit, but there are no studies that demonstrate a benefit. So, I mean, I tell patients if you do a trial and you feel like you have a reduction in your symptoms related to that, then I'm supportive of continuing it. But right now, we don't have good studies for me to really say that this is going to definitely make a difference.
Yeah, and I think particularly for children, we have to be very careful because taking away all milk products, calcium, vitamin D, there are some concerns. So we strongly encourage you, work with your primary care provider.
Absolutely.
Maybe
don't
get some more information.
Own.
Get some, maybe some testing and before you completely restrict perhaps something for the rest of your life. What's our very next house call question about radon?
I'm buying a new house. Should I get it tested for radon? And what does radon do to people anyway?
That is another great question. And one I faced the last time, or one of the times when I was buying a house, of do you get it tested or not?
Yeah, you know, I think I remember when we had an older house, we worried about this. But then when we, of course, built a newer house or bought a newer house, it didn't seem to come up as much. Is that still the way we think about this?
Yeah, well, just so everyone knows what we're talking about, radon is like a odorless gas that can be part of decay of radium or other products that can be included when people build houses. And so as it breaks down over time, if you ingest it or you inhale it over time, it has been linked to lung cancer and other bad health effects.
Yeah, in addition to active smoking and secondhand smoke as the number one and two causes of lung cancer, radon is then the third one. So it's you know, maybe less than 5%, but it's still something that's probably that we can do something about, because I do know that ventilation in the crawl spaces is certainly an important piece to ensure reduction in radon exposure.
You can buy these kits that'll measure it in your house. Some of them are free, but the problem is in one particular day or a couple days of time, you may not really get an accurate assessment of what's going on. So if you want to get a radon test, you really need to do a longer term test, at least according to the EPA and some of the resources that I checked.
Yeah, so if you're buying an older house and you're buying a house that does not have much of a crawl space or you know, then I think these are probably worthwhile. Yeah, I would go in and check the radon of the house and maybe have to do it several times to get a good reading. But certainly you could talk with your public health department.
Yes.
Some of the experts at the university who do work in radon for more information. And we'll try to post something on our website.
Hey, we've got some great librarians at the Health Services Library, and I bet that at the Health Sciences Library, and I bet they could find a good link for us on this one.
Excellent. Well, let's go to our very next question from a listener about gluten sensitivity.
Hi, I've been hearing a lot of talk about whether or not you should use gluten-free products. Should you use or eat gluten-free products if, in fact, you do not have any adverse reactions to eating gluten?
Wow, that's a really good question. You know, we talk about celiac disease or celiac sprue, these people who have gluten sensitivity, but we don't talk too much about this concern that maybe people who don't have this gluten sensitivity might have to developing the types of problems that people who have it.
So gluten is in wheat, it's in rye, barley, lots of different prepared foods.
It's a protein.
It's a protein called gluten that's in, you know, so much of what we eat. So this is another one that's really hard to have a gluten-free diet.
And it comes from the Latin word gluten or glue. That makes sense.
Interesting tidbit.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because it is the sort of thing that's used in cooking a lot of times to hold things together. And in a lot of foods we eat, like pizza dough and some of the other breads, it gives it, as the yeast rises, it gives it this chewy consistency. So it is part of what we really like about a lot of the foods we eat.
So the question is, are gluten-free products important or beneficial? And if you don't have celiac disease or any problems with your digestion from eating them, then at this point, as far as I know, Adam, there's no benefit to cutting that out of your diet.
Yeah, I think that it's less of a gluten issue than it would be a carbohydrate issue for a lot of people if they're really trying to make dietary changes to reduce the number of simple carbohydrates in their diet. And a lot of that may be in foods that have gluten, but I agree. I would not do this restriction. And again, it's one of those things I think a lot of people think they may have, and they restrict their diets more so than probably is justified. At least that's my opinion.
I'd say if you're going to pursue that route, do work with a doctor or a nutritionist to make sure you're getting everything you need for your health.
And let's listen to our very last house call today, this time about a very serious issue that we don't talk about a lot, but it's very important, syphilis.
Hello, good doctors. My brother was recently diagnosed with syphilis, but he doesn't have insurance, so he's forced to go to a free health clinic and is given a prescription that only lasts about 10 days. And once those 10 days are up and his prescription is used up, he's sick again, and he has to go back to get another prescription. So my question is this. Is there a difference in care received at a free public health center compared to a primary care practice?
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thanks. And our hearts go out to your brother, and know that that's a really, really difficult thing to deal with. And your question about different treatment from a public health facility or health department compared with a primary care practice, I got to tell you, when it comes to syphilis, I am so impressed with, at least in North Carolina, I'm not sure where your brother is, but we have some fantastic public health nurses and officials who really monitor this well, have protocols to follow, and I think they do a really good job. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I think in most cases, actually, the public health department probably has a better grasp on this than the private practitioner, because this is something they see a lot more of than the private practitioners. And since they see it a lot more, they're familiar with the treatment protocols more, they're going to be following patients a lot more. So I think I personally would be more reassured that they're in the public health system, that they're getting pretty good treatment.
And with syphilis, I mean, penicillin, I mean, there are different stages of syphilis. And so it can be very complicated if syphilis gets farther along. But penicillin in general is very effective if you follow the treatment protocol and keep coming back for those shots, usually get good results.
And I'm probably a little unclear why the illness at the end of 10 days and what that about. So, you know, I think if there's something that doesn't seem right, though, trust your instincts and do get it followed up, whether that is with the health department or with the primary care doctor. Find out what's going on, because there could be some other things that are related to both syphilis and the treatment, or even a third possibility. So we thank you for sharing that, and thank you all of you for sharing your questions with us today. We've had a nice chance to talk about gluten sensitivity and syphilis.
About radon in homes, and also a little bit about lactose intolerance. Thank you for sharing your questions with us and for being with us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, and we want you to share your questions and your stories by emailing us. You can reach us so many different ways. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can call us at 919-966-8081.
You can visit us at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes. Free podcast.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, documentary filmmaker Michael Kleinman.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL. This is Ron Stutz. WCHL always brings you complete coverage of Carolina. This is News Talk 1360 WCHL.